It is very difficult for me to speak about the awful experiences while I was in the concentration camp. But in a way, I'm happy to tape this interview with you. And I want not only you, Cody, but I feel everyone should know about the atrocities that Hitler and the Nazis brought upon our Jews.
I lived in Czechoslovakia, and in the year of 1944, we were occupied by the Germans, and they took us away to the ghetto. My father was well established, he was a businessman, and we had a beautiful home, maids, and so on, all the luxuries that any child would want to have when they were born or they lived through their years. For 14 years that I lived there, my home, they took us away to a ghetto which was in my home in Berehovo, and they brought there from the neighboring little small towns, they brought in all the Jews, and we all congregated, and we were all there in a factory, in an open factory where they made bricks, and we stayed there for about a month. Now all the young girls and young men were taken away to work in the ghetto, and some of the people that couldn't work, they gave everybody a certain thing to do. On May 29th, they loaded us on cattle cars. They put about 50 families into one car. Some people didn't have room even to sit or stand. As far as sleeping it was concerned, that was impossible. There we had to eat, drink. They allowed us a little bit of water, and whatever food we had, we took it into the car, which was very limited. We were riding, I believe, it was for 3 days and nights, without opening the door at all, till we arrived to our destination, which was Auschwitz. That was also called Birkenau. After arrival, the train, the door opened up. We were very shocked. We were very surprised to see there were a lot of German Gestapos with their guns, and there were blue and white striped men. Now, one of these men opened the door. There was standing a Gestapo next to him. I don't know whether I should mention it or not. But this man, the Gestapo was called away for a second, so the man opened his mouth, and I was standing there looking at me. He said to me, "How old are you?" So I said to him, "I was 14. He says, "You better say you're 17. And right away the guy saw him, the Gestapo, and he started yelling at him and screaming at him. And me as a child, I didn't know where they will ask me my age or what. So I turned to my mother and my father, and I said to them, "You know, this man told me I should say I was 17. I said, "Do you know where they're going to ask me my age? And shall I say I'm 17? So my mother and father didn't know what to say. They thought at that time I was bright enough and I'm going to use my judgment. At that point, they took us all off the train, and there were two lines going, and they set the men and the women, the children, to separate. On the right side, the women should stand in line, and on the left side, the men. And we didn't know where we were going or what's going to be. We were standing in line, but up the line, we saw some German officers, the Gestapos, and we were saw that they're questioning people and they're sending them left and right, and we didn't know, we just had to wait patiently. The children were crying, they were hungry, we all were thirsty, we wanted food, we were all tired out. Nevertheless, some of us were so tired we sat down, but the line kept on moving very fast. We saw there were very rough questioning as we came closer. There was a friend of my mother's holding a baby, and she said to my mother, "Could you kindly help me hold my baby?" But at that point, I said to my mother, "Please, just hold me. Don't hold anybody's child now." It was just like if I would have felt something is going to happen. And I started crying because I felt sorry for that poor woman. As we came along, we saw tears and crying. People were torn apart, mothers and children. And at that point, we still didn't know what's going to happen or where we're going to go. My father, at that point, is separated. I didn't see him for a while. I haven't seen him anymore until we just came up to Mengele. His name was Mengele, and some officers. And he looks at me, looks up and down, and he says to me in German, he says, "Wie alt bist du?" And I said to him, I first reminded myself, I'm supposed to say 17, I said 17. He says, so he started separating me from my mother. He put my mother away and threw her left. Didn't say anything to her, and he was going to tear me away from my mother to the right. I started crying, and I said to him, "No, ich bin 16, ich bin 15. Finally, I said to him, "I'm 14. He says, "Aber geh." And I was sent away in a group with the women, and we were lining up till the group came to this, till the end, our group from that train. Finally, crying, everybody was crying, we were all torn apart from our dear ones. As we were walking along, going with all the German Gestapos around like if we were criminals, we didn't know what was going on, what was happening. Maybe among, let's say, 100, maybe there were about 20 Gestapos all around. I don't know what they expected these helpless poor women and children to do. But as we were walking, we didn't know where we were going, I saw a group of men on my right side. And I was looking with all the Gestapos around them. And we thought, we were speaking among us, that these must be real criminals there, these men. And as I look, I saw my father, and I started crying and screaming. And I was tearing myself away from some of my parents' friends and some of the girls, the older ones that I knew. I believe I was one of the youngest ones among the group. As a result that I was lying, I was saying I was 17 because the young children, they separated. I ran out of my line going across, I don't know how far it was, about 100 feet at least. And I was running to my father, and you should have seen those guns pointing at me and yelling at me that if I don't leave, they will kill me. So I ran to my father, and I didn't want to leave his arms. And he tried to send me away because he saw that something is going to happen. And he was yelling to my friends and to his friends, they should all watch over me and watch his child. After all, I have to mention this. We were two children in our family, and my brother was taken away somewhere to work in some, I don't know, it was some kind of a camp. And that was 2 years before, and I've never seen my brother since. And there were 6 years apart between me and my brother, and I was the youngest, naturally. So as we were going along, they took us to a bed. They called it the sauna. Here they told us to get undressed, walking off and put everything down. Now, I know about myself, I don't know about somebody else. I had maybe 3 or 4 dresses on. Maybe this is why I saved myself too, because I was a very skinny girl and I looked, you know, like if I was really going to be able to do some good work for them. So we had to go and they took us in, like they sterilized us, they cleaned us and they washed us and we bathed, and most of all what they did to us, they shaved our hair off. And this was just terrible to each and every one of us, because we just didn't recognize each other. We didn't know who we were until we were speaking to one another. And it's unbelievable. I just can't tell you how we looked. I mean, I don't know if anybody can imagine that, to see that a whole bunch of women all shaved their beautiful hair off. I had the most gorgeous black long hair, dark hair. It was just gorgeous. I was crying. I didn't know what I was crying. Then I cried for my hair, but I didn't know that how much more I should have cried for. What I really should have cried for, that Mengele took my mother away and I was left all alone and miserable and lonely. After they gave us a certain uniform, a gray dress, everybody got the same dress with some clogs. But I had a pair of good shoes on. It was a custom-made pair of shoes. And I asked one of them if they would permit me to wear my own shoes. I don't know, but she felt sorry for me, I guess, one of those women in there. And she said that I can wear my own shoes. They took us after to a barrack. You would call it like a bunk bed, but it was like a chicken coops. It was from three parts. It was in the bottom, there was the stones, and then in the middle, we were pushed in about in a small coop, just sitting place you had. About 15 of us, and there were barely room to sit. You couldn't bend, you couldn't move, you couldn't hold your head up straight because you would get hurt, so you always had to lean. And there was the top, I guess on the top one there weren't too many, but in the middle they stuck us on so that they can keep an eye on us. This place, it's unbelievable, really, how this place looked. There were some Stubmeltesters, which is called the block, but in this big barrack, they were watching over us and some of their helpers, which have been there, those poor girls from Poland. They have been there since 1942. They didn't treat us well because I guess this was really jealousy. They always cursed us and they were unkind to us and just miserable and made us feel what they have poor girls felt for 2 years before. They kept on saying, we have built this for you. We came here in the winter when there was snow, barefoot, naked, and we had to build Auschwitz for you so that you come here and have all your conveniences. Mind you, we couldn't bend our head down or up, straightening up. But at that point, you know, the first day, everything was hurting. Naturally, you get used to everything. So once a day, we got a piece of bread that lasted, it's a slice of bread that lasted for all day. And in the evening, we got a bowl of soup that was made out of grass. And I tell you, it is unbelievable, but I couldn't eat it the first few days. I wanted to throw up, but how could you keep this up? I used to close my nose and eat, because I really wanted to survive. I wanted to see what was waiting for me yet. I hoped that I'd be able to meet my parents again and see them. And anyway, as we, in the mornings, about they woke us up, it was still dark out, and they called it the Zellerpell. They called us out. We had to stand five in a line, and they counted us. And we had to stand there. Sometimes it was cold, you know, early in the morning. We were practically naked with that dress on us. And we had to stand there for hours, till it was our next that we should be counted. And God forbid, if there was somebody missing, let's say, I don't know from how many thousands of people or women, if somebody was missing, we would have to stand there for hours and hours till that particular party was found. If we wanted to go to it was called the Latrina, we were always watched and taken. You would call it the bathroom, which I would never call it a bathroom. Anyway, one night I didn't feel well, and I asked to walk. They should walk me out because I had cramps. So one of the women, one of the girls took me out, one of those, I don't know, was one of the girls that were there already long before us. And she pulled me by my dress. She says, come. And as I go out, I saw the whole camp is lit. I couldn't understand what it was. I said, what is that fire? I said, such a big fire. She says, don't you know what that is? That is the gas chamber. You see, there is your mother burning. And I started crying. And I couldn't understand how could somebody be so miserable, so mean. I said, what do you mean my mother is burning? And then she explained to me that this is a gas chamber, that all those people that were taken away to the left side, they're burning them there. And this is why I see the camp lit up. Well, I can't tell you how I felt for many, many, many days. What was behind my mind and how I felt naturally, like any child would feel of my age, because as I said before, I mentioned that I knew maybe there were not 1% my age there, because they were all taken away. I was among the youngest one there. Naturally, I got some sympathy. Why? Because I spoke fluently German, which very few people did. My mother came from Czechoslovakia, part of Czechoslovakia, where they have spoken German. So in our home, we have spoken German. Also, I want to mention that in 1938, we were occupied by the Hungarians, and at that, you know, so I actually went to Czech school. When I was in Slovakia, I went to German school and Slovak school, and also in Hungarian school. But the German, I must say, that language saved me all the way through. They always sympathized with me. Finally, one morning I woke up, I see a very familiar face. And I saw this is a big shot. And I said to myself, where do I know this girl from? Finally, till I reminded myself that this girl comes from the town my mother came from, Slovakia, and her sister was a very close friend of mine, and I dared to walk over to her and ask her whether this is her. First of all, she looked at me because, after all, she had some position there in the camp. And finally, she took me around, and she knew the head of my Brukelteste, it was called, the head of this barrack. And she asked her whether I can be excused for in I don't know in how many weeks at that point. And she gave me a scarf, and she gave me a sweater, and she told me anytime that anytime I want to see her, I should tell the Brookhilters that she'll get in touch with me, and she'll come and pick me up and take me to her for a while and feed me. Well, you know, not everything works out the way really it should, because if when I asked her to do this favor for me, she just looked at me, you know, that our Brookhilters there, she looked like if I was nuts. I don't know why. Finally, I have to come to this point where, you know, you weren't allowed to be sick here. Because God forbid, if anything hurt you, they take you away to the infirmary. And actually, this will help you there. They take you straight to the gas chamber. There were some elderly women, you know. And naturally, I was always taught respect, and that was still with me. You know, once you taught something, I guess this is instilled in you, and you just don't forget it. So these poor women asked me, you are such a young child, why don't you go down and lie down there on the stones, and let us have a peaceful night sometimes, and maybe we'll change around sometimes. Well, actually, I had no choice in the matter. They practically kicked me out at that point. You know, nobody cared for anybody but themselves. And I used to sleep down there. And what can I tell you? It was cold. It was miserable. I felt a chill. And I got very, very sick. Very sick. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid to tell anybody I'm sick because I knew they were going to take me away immediately. But, you know, God was very good to me and very kind to me. There came along a nurse. She was also one of our people, but she was there. She was working for the Germans, naturally. And she always came to check every day if there were sick people. So when there were sick people, they took them away. Because naturally, they couldn't. How much can you help these people there? I asked her, and I spoke to her in German. She walked by me. I told her that I feel I'm very sick. I had temperature at that point. She took my temperature. And she patted me all over my face. She says, poor child, what am I going to do with you now? Don't tell anybody, she says. I don't want to report you. I really have to, but don't tell it. I'm going to give you some pills. And you take it. And I'm going to check with you, but don't make it obvious. Because well, if somebody will see it, they will report me. I must have had, I started coughing terribly. I was very sick, and that time she said to me that you must have pneumonia. And I believed it because I was coughing, I had temperature, I had aches and pains, chills for days and days and days, backaches. And this girl, God bless her, wherever she was, wherever she is, if she's alive, she really helped me. She never reported me. And some of my friends, when we had to get up 6 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the morning and stand outside, you know, they propped me up in the back because I couldn't stand on my legs. I must have been terribly weak. But I prayed to God. I prayed, always prayed to God, and I asked him, please help me, let me see my mother and father again. I also would like to mention that they took us away, you know, to work in some ditches, to make some ditches that in case, you know, there is going to be any attacks on the camp, so that the Germans should have where to ditch. Or they took us away to the kitchen where we had to pick up those heavy cans, you know, where they put the food in and we had to carry them. Believe me, this, if they put me on that, I just had no strength for that. And that we used to work in the ditches and many times used to talk about escaping. Believe it or not, there were so many guards around us those guns, that looking at them, you were afraid even to do the wrong move. But believe it or not, it happened many times. We heard the alarm go off. And when the alarm go off, that means that some people try to escape. Now, this Auschwitz was, you know, had different sections. It said Lager A, Lager B, and Lager C, and the different kind of rooms where they, you know, they took people for interviews. They also had there a hospital where they took some women and some men
to do some medical experiments on them.
I met at that time somebody that was taken in to that hospital and came up more dead than alive. What they did to this party, they cut off her skin from her leg and they poured on her alcohol and they lit it with fire. Well, she really gave up living then. I don't know how, I can't remember exactly how I came to speak to that girl. I think they took us once, I don't remember exactly, but they took us, I believe, once a week to that sauna to take a bath, to take showers. And I must have met her somewhere there. I don't know how she got there. I don't know anything about her. But this left me in such a state of shock that, you know, now I had two things to live with already. I saw the fire and I saw the story of this girl. You know, we were so naive at that point yet. We really honestly didn't know what was going on yet. We just lived with our, we lived with our fears, as to say, with our troubles. And we just didn't know what's going to happen. Finally, we found out that there are groups being taken away to Germany and to work in the factories, ammunition factories, and steel factories. So everybody started praying to be taken away. I didn't know what to pray for. But finally, at one point, they said to all of us to come and line up. We didn't know what it was going to be, but when we lined up and we saw a truck standing in front and the Germans, who do you think I saw there? That same rotten face, that Mengele. At that point I knew his name. Mengele, he was the biggest Nazi doctor, the biggest anti-Semite. He was a real Jew killer. Believe it or not, if I had this guy in front of me now, I think I'd burn him with fire. And I don't think I would just burn every finger every day off his. Because what he did, this man did, this is unbelievable. Now wait till I tell you what he did to me now. We came, we lined up and five of us standing in line and we were moving up. He was looking over everybody. Again, he sent some girls, right? And some of them on the truck, naturally. I was a skinny pickle at that point, and I was a young child. He sent me on the truck. As I had no choice, there were guards all over. As I was going on the truck, you know, there always came something into my mind. And you had to work here very fast, because if you didn't, you know, what was going to happen? I felt no matter what's going to happen, if I go on this truck, I knew I'm going to that fire there, to the gas chamber. So I started running. As I was running, they all started running after me. But there were so many barracks, I just ran and ran till I turned in and I sneaked in a barrack. Finally, I knew I'm out of there. And I sneaked in and most probably they gave up looking for me because there were so many, they certainly wouldn't know who I am. So I ran into the barrack, and guess what? I saw an aunt of mine and two of my cousins there. And they started crying because I told them what has happened. So So they said to me, you know, there is the line that you renovate from that was lining up to go to Germany. And maybe if you try to sneak into that line, maybe you can get out of there. So you know what I did? I ran into the line, and they were looking at me like crazy, all these women and girls. I said, you can't stand in the line, you are top of us. I said, please help me. I said, move down. Just move along, move down, one of you, all along, just push everybody down, and let me stand in, let me be the fifth, and don't let me stand with you, and let me stand somewhere in the middle. And believe it or not, this is what we did. Finally, as Mengele finished, and I saw what he was doing, I saw him finish, you know, alongside his job, they took us to the zona, and there they told us again, sit and wait outside, and they got us all undressed, and we were sitting there, I don't know, that for many, many hours. We were all hungry, starved, but we knew here at the zona we have to go through another inspection, and once we got undressed, we knew this is it. They're going to examine us, and they're going to I don't know, either they're going to burn us or they're going to take us away or something. But we didn't know really what was coming. So imagine what I was doing. I was pinching my face all along. I was pinching my face. I shouldn't be pale. I should be pretty. I should be red in my face. So they will think I have enough blood maybe in me. And I'll be able to go to Germany and work for those rotten Nazis. And finally the time came. They were going, and there again a truck showed up. So I figured myself, now, it's now or never. So we were going one at a time, just marching around and waiting for what's going to happen. All of a sudden, as we were marching, he kept on saying, those that went straight, they went straight. Those that he wanted out on the truck, he just pointed at them. Can you believe it? I passed it. I passed him. He didn't pick me out of that line. So I said to myself, God is good to me. And maybe I'll have a chance to live yet now. So they took us in there. They clothed us. They gave us, again, the same uniform. But this was a clean dress, I guess. A new gray dress with some wooden shoes. And they took us up on in the cattle carrier. They put us 50 in one cattle car, 50 girls and two Gestapo women in there. And as we went up there, the first thing they asked, is there anybody that speaks German? Because most of these women, they've spoken Yiddish. They have spoken, some of them Czech, and most of them spoke Hungarian, because, you know, at this point we got all mixed up already. I was the only one speaking German there, and so I raised my hand, and they called me over, and I was the interpreter for them. I used to tell them, and they wanted me to stay next to them. I was really sleeping next to them and sitting next to them, because every time they wanted to tell something to the girls, I was supposed to tell them. I must say, as a result, they treated me very nicely. They were yelling and screaming at everybody, but they were very nice to me. And I made friends there with five girls. They were all older than I was. And once a day, we got our rations. It was a big piece of bread. And some kind of a cheese, and that was for the whole day. And we divided us, and I used to get a double portion. And whatever they ate, they always used to give me something. And I went, and I always divided up between these five girls, because I was very close with them at that point. remember for how long, but I know that many times that the alarm went off and the train stopped and we heard the planes. They were bombing some places and we were standing in front of some wilderness there, and they all jumped out the train and they ran into the woods and they left us all there till the alarm went off again, and you know, that meant that you know, that the bombing was over wherever it was close by, and they came back and we continued on. We were going to Hamburg. In Hamburg, we were taken, it was next to a port. We were in some kind of a big auditorium. And in the bottom, like the ocean water came in. And I'm sure you know that Hamburg was bombed day and night. And every time, naturally, most of the time, the bombs fell in that night. And they took us down into the water, and we were sitting down sometimes all night, praying to God. We heard the bombs fell so close, we were all praying that it shouldn't hit us. But sooner or later, I found out why it didn't hit us. We went to work to a factory, and there were some of these German the workers. Naturally, we weren't allowed to talk to them because he would have gotten fired or something. So, but we sneaked sometimes and we told them who we were. They wanted to know who we were. They didn't know. And we told them who we were and what we're doing. And they said, "Don't be silly. You know why you're not bound?" Says, "You are standing next to the biggest bridges. And they want to bomb that bridge. They cannot bomb that bridge because they know you are right next there." All the English and the Americans, they know where you are staying. They wouldn't bomb the places. Finally, one day, we get up in the morning and they tell us we're leaving. And we were taken to Eigelstadt. Eigelstadt, I think that was, I don't know how far it was, I don't know where it was really. But over there they took us, believe it or not, we were building houses. And here again my German came in very handy, because I was speaking to these foremen, and they told us how to build these houses. We were carrying those tremendous big brick blocks. And then they made me forelady of 10, 12 girls. Me, the youngest one, I guess because I was talking German, and I was supposed to tell everybody what to do, how to do. Believe it or not, I was measuring, and everything should come out perfectly. I built houses at 14. I can really say that. These small little houses. There was one German foreman. He was a hell of a nice guy. He always tried to sneak to talk to me, and he felt terribly sorry for me. He says, "You must be the youngest around here." He says, and finally he confided in me. First of all, he brought me every day lunch. When he brought himself lunch, he brought me lunch. Nobody was supposed to know about it, naturally. I also, again, I divided it. I never ate it up myself. I'm very, very proud to say it, that I didn't want to be different than everybody else. And he finally told me that where we are staying, he says, they are not far away from us. He lives very close by. And that he was a communist, he told me. And he asked me if I knew what it means. And at that time, I'll be very honest with you, I didn't know too much. I knew that he must be a friend of mine if he confided in me. And he told me that he works for the underground, and they live very close to us, our camp is surrounded, and we should know, I should tell the women, the girls that I can trust, I should tell them that we shouldn't be scared. If I don't believe in anything anymore. And people give up hope and everything. Staying in this camp.
What was the name of this camp?
This was in Eidelstadt. I really don't know. But I know we went by trolley car to work. We were building the houses. After these houses were finished, they took us to sort bricks. That means from the bombed houses that were bombed, used to pick up all the bricks and set them up. I guess they were using them after. So we set them up. And we were going on trolley cars back from work and to work and from work. It took us, it took us a good hour to travel.
What kind of living quarter was it?
Living quarters was three barracks. These three barracks, we were divided in different, these barracks had like four rooms each barrack, and they, we had bunk beds. And in each room there were about 50 girls. That's it. We were, I believe, about 500 girls. We were in this camp, 500 of us. 500. And we had, I don't know whether I should mention it, but I have to tell you this story, because this is, I think, a very, very interesting story. You know, all camps were being visited by, you know, Obersturmführers. You know, they come to visit the camps and see if the Lagerführer, the one that takes care of the camp, with all the Germans, with the officers, whether they are doing a good job on us, if they are training us properly, actually. They made us go wash every day, and we were supposed to wash our clothes properly, and we had coats, and there was an infirmary, and when you needed a needle and thread, you were supposed to go and get it, and sew our clothes, so that they wanted to be proud of us, you know, that we go out, that they wanted to show off to the public that they treat us so beautifully. Actually, we wore I brought you the guards from your mother. I said, you did what? I started crying even more. I couldn't believe it. I still couldn't believe what was going on. So he tells me, no, excuse me. First he asked me what my name was. And then he asked me my father's name, which I answered him. And he asked me my mother's name. And then he asked me where I come from and what business my father was in. And I answered all his questions. I told him my father was in the wine business. And then at the end he told me that he brought me regards from my mother. I was in a state of shock, believe it or not. I just didn't know what was coming over me. I couldn't believe him. I said to him finally, in German, I said to him, well, where is my mother? He says, your mother is in Lübeck, which is 60 miles from here. She's a Blockältester. That means she is taking care of the camp. As I said, my mother was perfect German speaking too, so she must have had a position working for them. And as a result, because these Obersturmführers come to camp during the day, and he must have spoken to my mother, and my mother begged him to, you know, try to see, since he's visiting camps, to try to see if he will be able to find me. And he says, endlich, he says, finally, I found you. I'm going to go back to your mother, and I'm going to tell her that I found you. And you know something? You're really as pretty as your mother told me. I black eyes, dark eyes, and he described me, he had every description of me on in the notebook, and he showed it to me. And he said to me, next time you come again, I come again here, and I will talk to you again. And this is when he left. Now, from now on, I was called the wonder child of camp, and everybody women are here also very happy, and they can verify everything. They still, I haven't seen them for years, but I met them once, and we discussed this matter, because they said this was something, this was unbelievable. From now on, I was called the Wonder Child. But I was wondering, really, they called me the Wonder Child, but I was really crying and being miserable from then on, because I knew my mother is close, yet so far away. And here I thought that they burned her. And I had to believe him, because he was so convincing, and he had everything written down on a piece of paper, and he showed it to me. If he would have just told me my mother's name, my father's name, but he described me the looks of, you know, everything, how I looked. He described everything to me. This was very close now. We felt the bombs were falling naturally every night. We were hiding under the bed. The bombs were falling all around, very, very close. The whole city was lit up. It was just miserable to look at the lit up the night, you know. It looked like it was day. We always prayed to God. I learned the prayer, a very, very long prayer from somebody. A very, very, very religious woman, and she knew all these prayers by heart. I learned one of the prayers. And every time the bombs fell, I said this prayer, and I asked God to save my life yet. Because now I had something to hope for and to live for. I knew my mother was alive, and she was so close. This lasted, we were here yet, 2 more weeks. Now, just a few days before, I have to tell you what happened another thing. That also, I had a feeling that something is going to happen. We went to work, a nice day, it was beautiful. As we were coming home, going back to our trolley, we came on a trolley car back and forth from work for about an hour. This Eichelstadt was near Hamburg. And we traveled here, back and forth. We worked in this steel factory where we were with the iron brush. We used to brush the iron. Now every noontime, usually the bombs came. We were near a forest there. The bombs fell and we saw it. It was so near, so we always used to run into the forest, and we used to lie down on the floor and pray to God. Now here, this once, after the bombs fell very close, and after we got up and we wanted to go back to work, you know, one of these splinters, the bomb fell, and about a few of my friends died instantly there, very close. And after bombing was over, we were standing up, and right next to me, a shell from a bomb that, you know, when we heard it coming, but we didn't know where from, we didn't know what to do, and it went by near my arm, and it killed my friend right next to me. And when I saw this, I was in a state of shock. I couldn't believe it. My arm ached me. I don't know, was it pressure or my ear? I was deaf on my ear for days and days. I just didn't know what was happening. And this was really terrible. This incident really, because at that time about 6 of my friends died right there from the bombs. And this was already such a shock to us all that we just didn't care for anything at that point. But
tenth father was a great rabbi, and we were very religious at home, and you know, this was instilled in me. And you know, when you are in pain and in misery, you just feel, you, some of the girls used to say, well, we don't believe in God because there is no God around. God took away everything from us, took away our dearest ones, our parents, everything. And now our friends are dying when they have maybe something to live for yet, even though we didn't know what was going to happen. How this happened, it was too much for us in the same week, because when we went home, about 2 days later from camp, from work, when we went home, yes, something else what we used to do, and we used to, you know, clean those, what do you call it, bricks, and we used to pile them up. You know, sometimes we used to notice that there is some food laying around. Maybe we had to walk a little bit away and steal something. So we used to, one at a time, two at a time, at one place, I remember distinctly, we used to change off, and we used to steal, what do you call it, the reedy, that is called, you know, what you give to eat for the cattle. I don't even know what it's called. It's some kind of a beet. But some kind of a beet. It's not the red beet. It's some kind of a white beet that you feed animals. I don't know where this place was located, but we have seen a pile, and we were on it. Until, thank goodness, the officers, the Germans, you know, the cars didn't notice it. I don't know how this happened either, but this helped us a little bit along with the food for a couple of days. But one of the days that we went home, I had a very, very strange feeling. There were three trolley trains that we went in, and we were assigned to which one to go on. There was number one, number two, and number three. I always used to go on number one. I was assigned to number one. And for some one reason or another, I can't remember, I think my shoelace opened up. And I wanted to tie my shoelace. And I was staying in back of the line, most probably, and I told officer, I have to tie my shoelace. Meanwhile, you know, all the girls went on the train, and the trolley was going to go already, and I was, so I told him that I have to go over there. So he said, never mind, you go on here. And this was the last one, the third one. And, you know, I was very strange, because with these girls on this train, I never went home. We worked there for months, but I never went home with these girls. So, you know, I felt a little bit strange there. I didn't have my family with me, you know, and after such a heavy day of work, you know, you wanted to be together and talk. All Jewish girls, there were some French, they were all mixed already. I mean, at this point, you know, they were all mixed up because I sneaked into the you know, in Auschwitz, yes, and this is the same group. There were French girls, there were some from Belgium, from Hungary, from Czechoslovakia, and no, there were no Germans, but I think that we had a couple of Holland girls. And as we were going along, bingo, a bomb house fell on the train, and we started screaming, yelling, jumping, and we couldn't get out, so I broke a window, I remember, and I jumped out from the train. It was stopping at that point, but the first two cars were all smashed with screams and cries. Dead girls, there were dead blood gushing all around, broken legs, broken hands, and I don't know, there must have been at least, I don't know how many deaths among us. And I remember
that the Germans, they took them away, a lot of ambulances I saw, and they were talking, well, what do you care? But they don't mean a thing to us.
You see, Goldie?
Is that how, when God wants to save you, and you can really see there is God in heaven, because I never was in the third car. Only the girls from the third car were saved. From the other two cars, most of them, 99%, were injured, and there was at least, I don't know how many percent death there. But again, a miracle happened to me. You know, many times I say to myself, you know, that I can write a book of my life, and nevertheless, I skip so much that is unbelievable. But I would like to come to a close. We left here, Eidelstadt, as many as we were left, we went to Vado, because the Americans and the English, they were closing in, as it seems, and they took us deeper into Germany, away. And we were on the way to Bergen-Belsen. Now, I'm sure you read about Bergen-Belsen. You know, Bergen-Belsen was called the Vernichtungslager. That means, over there you can't come out alive. They don't feed you. You just die of starvation, of life, of you don't get food there. We were walking for days, I remember, and in any some of the girls that fell down, they just shrunk or they threw them into the ditch. Those that could walk, they walked. And we came very close to Bergen-Belsen at the doors. Now again, I don't know, there were some German officers standing and they were pulling girls out. And we were just right at the gates of the camp. There were so many girls around. They were, you know, there was no order there no more. They didn't care no more because people were dropping dead there, you know, every second of the day. So there was an officer pointing at me. And I knew what was coming. They're taking me away. I started running. I know already what to do. At this point, I was experienced already. I know I have to run or do something. And as I took a chance before all the time, which happened before too, which I haven't mentioned, but this is important. They picked out girls to take to the front for the German officers. And they used these girls, and after that they shot them. So one of the guys pointed at me, and I started running. And I ran, boy. And again, comes in, because I didn't know where to go. This place was strange to me. I never see this place. Finally, they put us again in these barracks. And this was filled right. There was everything under the sun. It wasn't joy and it wasn't happiness. It was pure misery. Where you have seen dead people all around you, food you have never gotten, but you have seen there was ditches of water and these poor girls was lying there on the ground and eating grass, if there was some grass, and drinking that water. I mean, we were desperate. At that point, nothing mattered. But I want to tell you, I always had hope. I always believed there is God in heaven. And, they used to, you know, some of the girls got beaten up. I didn't even mention this. Some of the girls got beaten up many, many times. They didn't walk straight or didn't look straight. As a matter of fact, one of the girls, that goes back, I forgot to mention it, but I feel I should mention something about this, about these beatings and hittings. What do you call it? In Hamburg, I remember, there were
clever stories with the German officers. They used to come up at night in this big barrack, but they were very friendly with the couples, with the girls, with the, some of these girls that were blockout testers. And they had no choice of resisting. They had no choice. But some of these girls, I remember back that, you know, there was a particular girl I remember. She was a young girl too, and she went, I remember her walking with her hem down, and I walked over to her, I said, why don't you go and get a piece of thread and needle and sew up your hem? He said, I used to say, what do you need? They should pick on you and then get killed. You need it? He said, I don't care anyway no more. I lost my brothers, my sisters, my mother, my father. What is there to live for me? I can't suffer anymore. And you know, it did happen. One of the German officers saw it, he took her, and I remember they took her into a little shack it was there, I don't even remember how it looked anymore, and they beat her to death with a, you know, they had a special, what's that belt, I don't know, it's called a whip, yeah, with a whip, they had a special kind of a whip, and when we saw that whip, we knew what was coming. So, I mean, this happened, you know, all along. I mean, I just felt that, I don't know whether I should have mentioned it, I shouldn't have mentioned it, but these things happened along the way. I mean, here in Bergen-Belsen, it was different. There was no work, no nothing. There weren't even so many guards in our block, you know, to watch over us, but there were plenty around, you know. All of a sudden, you know, they came into our room, they, you know, we were the strong ones yet. This was 2 weeks before liberation. We got liberated April the 15th. This was, you know, in the year of 1945 already. And we came to Bergen-Belsen 2 weeks before liberation, you know, when the front came very close. And this is when they brought us here already. And you know, we were yet the new ones they brought in. So they couldn't go over to those that were three quarters dead. They couldn't stand on their legs anymore and ask them if they want to volunteer to come and do some work. So they came naturally to the newcomers because they knew, you know, they are full of strength. What they thought strength, I don't know. But I was always, if any time they asked for help, no matter where I was, or to do anything. I mentioned to you that I was, the bombs were falling and I was washing those cans that the food came in just because I wanted an extra portion of soup. Because, you know, I wanted to survive. I had hope. And I had a lot of hope. I always hoped. And I was the first one to raise my hand. I said to myself, look, where can they take me now already here? If I'm in camp, I said, and if they ask a few women to come and help out, and by this point I was starved and I didn't care for anything anymore. And they told us, these German Gestapo, these women, they called us, tell us we want to come and clean up their rooms. And believe it or not, I was most than happy to go, because I knew it's a little bit out of the camp. And no matter where you went to help a little bit or do something for them, I always felt something will come along with me, a little bit of food, a little bit extra. You know, and we did go, a few of us, and we cleaned these Gestapo, these officer rooms for the women. And naturally, we got something out of it. We got some bread, piece of bread in return. But how much was it? Was a slice. Believe it, it didn't amount to anything, but every little bit helps. And so we came back, and we were happy. And every time they asked us, you know, to go to help us, I was the first to go. And how could I go? This was only a couple of days that we really had the strength yet. Now there came one day, they came and they asked us to come and produce some work. I was hesitant of going, but I figured, you know, I'll go. They took us, we were walking, but I didn't know there was a camp for men at that time over there. I just saw women on one side. They took us for a walk, and right alongside the women's camp, there was a camp for men. And as we were walking there, I saw the most horrifying thing that any human being can just imagine. I saw a line of men going, walking alongside, with dragging dead people, tied their legs and their hands together, and they were pulling them, you know, in line. There were so many dead, and piling them up stories high. And I saw stories high of men lying around, men and women. When they were piled up like you pile up, you know, bricks. Then I really lost my strength. This was terrible. It was horrifying. And as we passed, there was another camp for women. Now these women were there, you know, for a long time already, and they couldn't stand on their legs anymore. They were crawling on these barbed wires. These wires weren't, you know, most of the camps, the wires were, these particular wires weren't, they didn't have no electricity in them. So they were crawling, they saw new lives. They saw, you know, women here that could walk. They haven't seen anything like that, you know, because the people were drying there like flies. All of a sudden we go with these German officers, and we see there a pile of, a big pile of these reading that I said before. They fed this to the animals. Then I found out that these were, they cooked for us. I don't even know. It looked like a white something. And when we saw this, our lives didn't matter at that point, anything. It didn't matter no more because we saw these dead people, so we knew we're not getting out here alive. Somebody started running, and he started kicking them, and the officers, the German officers, they started shooting at us, and the dead fell left and right. And at that point, you know what I noticed? We had the Hungarian Gestapos, which I haven't seen before, but here in Bergen-Belsen, they had Hungarian Gestapos. They were yelling and screaming in Hungarian. And they were shooting. You know, the shells flew near my ear. I remember I just didn't care. And I picked up about two or three. I put it in my dress, you know. And I come back and I turn around. Who do I see there at the gate? Two of my cousins. You know who? Rosie and Piri. And they started crying and yelling, and they said to please give them some food. And I went, I had a little knife, I don't know, I remember I got that from this guy in Hamburg, this foreman. And I always used to hide it, that when they examined me, I don't even know how I had it already, in the belt or something, that they never found it on me, because they always used to examine, you know, see what we have on us. Couldn't have anything on us. I used to cut it and give it to them, and they said to me that an aunt of mine was there, Susnina was there, and that she can't walk anymore, she can just crawl. So I said to her to please carry her out, bring her out, so I can give her some food, maybe she'll be able to stand on her legs again and save her life. And when she saw me, they brought her out, she cried and screamed. And I want to tell you, this happened, you know. The German officers were very busy with the shooting there, so they couldn't take care of us. So meanwhile, we had a chance to do this. So, and I gave away each and every piece. I had three of these beads, and I gave them all away. I remained without anything. And I said to myself, that God, I gave away everything. Now I haven't got what to eat. And I asked from the people to give me a piece. They wouldn't give me anything. You know what I did? I said to myself, if God saved me so far, I have to take a chance once more. And I ran, I picked up a bit and I ran back and they didn't shoot me. And April the 15th, this is already now the end. Now the end, a few days before we were liberated, I already stayed only on my cot. I couldn't walk. I only crawled already because I didn't have any more strength. And we heard the tanks very close by, and we heard shooting and everything, and we knew something is going to happen. And finally the day came, April the 15th, 1945, the day I will never forget in my life. A big tank with an English officer speaking in Yiddish on the tank was yelling, "Kinderlach isn't cry. Children, you are all free. We are here to help you and to save you. And we're going to do everything possible for you. We'll try to bring you to the hospitals and you'll be taken care of. And you just try to hold yourself. Don't give up now. You suffered so much. And we knew all about it, and we were trying to get here as soon as possible." And he said, "You will get right away, we're setting up camp here, and you will get milk." So we used to get the condensed milk. You know, everybody was so starved. So a lot of them, you know, died from over-drinking so much milk and everything, even though, you know, they watched, and doctors were full. At that point, I remember it. What I remember next is only one thing, that I was unconscious already, and I was taken to a hospital. I was laying in a hospital over there in Bergen-Belsen. It was all set up. I was lying there in a hospital, and I had typhoid. And I know that I had it in my head and in my stomach. And I must have run very high temperature. I mean, this is what I'm telling you now is what I was told about me by the doctors after. I was unconscious for many, many, many days. I may say weeks. They gave us medications. I didn't know what was happening. I only know that I always used to speak out of my fever. I always used to say, it was still in my mind, obviously my mother, I used to say, you know, my mother is downstairs and, you know, Shabbat is coming and she's lighting the candles. And after she lights the candles, she's going to come to me and she's going to take care of me because her child is very sick. This is what they told me I used to say. And I am not going to be worried anymore. And I was lying in this hospital. There was an English doctor and he must have taken a liking to me because this doctor took very, very good care of me. I found out later by this doctor, and he told me that when I was conscious already, he said to me like this, "You know, we are getting big professors coming from England, and you know what they discovered? They discovered a new drug," he said, "penicillin." And he said, "They're bringing into this hospital maybe a very, very few of them, and guess who is going to get it?" He said, "You are going to be the one. And I'm going to save your life." This English officer said to me. And at that point, you know, he used to come in every hour on the hour. He used to send nurses because he saw I was a very young kid and he felt very sorry for me. And he used to say that he wants to bring me back to England. And I said to him, then already I felt better. And I said to him, "You weren't a Jew. And I don't think I was going to go with you." He was a young doctor. And I remember at that time that naturally the penicillin must have helped me. And they took, then we met already different kind of people from all over, all those that were saved. And I met a cousin of mine. And you know what he said to me? He said, "You know, I met somebody and they told me that your mother was a big shot in Auschwitz. I don't know how she saved her life, but she has saved a lot of people their lives because her German, her language helped her, obviously. And she was so nice. so good. This was a guy that escaped, and they found him. He said to him that my mother was taken from Lübeck on a boat to Sweden. There was an exchange, you know, in Sweden with the Red Cross, I believe. And my mother was on a boat, and the boat near the port somewhere, it exploded from a mine. It had a mine explosion, and there were maybe 3 or 4 people saved on that boat. And he said, you know, and I said to myself, I didn't think I'm ever going to meet you to be able to tell you that, but I want you to know that I heard that your mother had saved her 2 sisters' lives at that time. So this is what I found out about my mother. And as far as all the youngsters had a chance of going to Sweden, but I said to myself, no, I must go back home, because I felt that my father must be alive. If he was taken to camp to work, he must be alive. And we were going on, and I decided not to go to Sweden. And as we were going home on cattle trains, open cattle trains, whatever, you know, ways we had to, were able to go, we went, I decided to go back to Czechoslovakia, which at that point was Russian now, because the Russians occupied it. And on the way going, I saw a lot of men and boys, and they were changing trains. It was, you know, it was unbelievable what was going on. We had a lot of food because we stole a lot from the Germans, and they, you know, whatever we could find. And there was a young boy, and I said to him, every time I saw a man, I used to ask him, maybe you were together with this man who came, my father, and I used to describe him, how he looked out, and I went home with my aunt, this particular aunt, that I saved her life, you know. Fascinating. I met her in a hospital. I saw her, and we went home together. We came from the same town. And I took her, and we went together home. And on this train, that particular night, it was an open train, I remember. And this boy came over to me in the middle of the night, and he shook me, and he woke me up. He says, you know what? He says, I know who your father was, and I think I was with him in camp together. He says, what do you mean? He says, I remember this man because this man saved my life. He was a capo, a head of this camp, and he was so good that he let everybody, he tried to help everybody, and as a result, on account of me, he was beaten up once almost to death. And they ordered him to beat me up, and he said, I'm not going to hit my brother. And they beat him up, and I tell you, your father is alive, and I'm sure. And I cried. I said to my aunt, and this man, and he said that my father is alive. So I had again what to live for now. And as we were coming to Prague, and then we were already in regular trains. We didn't have fare, naturally, but they didn't expect us to pay. So they told, you know, there was a man looking for from people from Berehovo, and everybody that was from Berehovo came running to the man. He was from my city. As a matter of fact, he's a very close neighbor to me, and he brought me the news. You know, he said to me, you know, he says, your father is at home with your brother. So I was thrilled. Believe me. I don't know if I have room here anymore to tell you, but I wanted to tell you that when I arrived home, so maybe I'll just skip it. We came home, you know, I met my father. It was the first day, I remember, it was Tisha B'Av, 9 days of Av, that was in August, and somebody went to tell my father, he lived in a hotel, he had some money hidden, and lived in a hotel, and they went to tell him that I came back home. And he started crying. He said, why are you teasing me? Just last week somebody told me, they told them that I was dead. Nevertheless, you know, a father is always a father. He came running, and this is the time I met him. And we were saved. And thank goodness we
lived in Czechoslovakia. We had to escape from Russia back to Czechoslovakia. We lived there in Prague for a while. And I came here to this country, in this beautiful country, this free country, in the year of October the 10th, 1947. This was one of the happiest days of my life.
I got married. I have a wonderful husband, 4 lovely children. 3 of them are married. I have 4 grandchildren. God bless them. They bring me joy and happiness. You see, Goldele, when you want to go through life, you go through, and you still can come out. If God wants to help you, He can do anything under the sun. I hope that you and none of your sisters and brothers will go through this that I have gone through. God bless America.